Good evening. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. I know you're all anxious for me to give you a rundown, an analysis of what happened at the People's Temple, the involvement of Charles Gary and Mark Lane in that operation, and my opinions or views for whatever they're worth. I don't mean to disappoint you, you loyal listeners, or put you off a week, but I really do want to assimilate the information that's come out so far. There's an information overload, as there is in every large intelligence type of operation, and information is coming out through all the various networks and talk shows and through the newspapers, and will be going on for a long, long time. I don't want my opinion, my hatred for Mark Lane, to get in the way of my objectivity of this case. The question is whether he was an innocent dupe or whether he is the Rasputin and the manipulator that I've accused him of being in the past. Will remain open until next week, probably. Those of you that listen continuously, that have listened to Dialogue Conspiracy or have taken the tapes, know that constantly I have talked about him, particularly when he took a part into the Hustler operation with Paul Krasner last year. And many, many times I talk about Mark, but I talk so much that as soon as his name was mentioned down in Guyana and with the People's Temple, the phone began ringing, and I was getting about 75 calls in the last 3 days on the matter. So finally I decided that people could order tape number 365, which is December the 1st. Next Friday I'll do a tape just on the People's Temple and hopefully answer some of your questions and give you my overview of what I think took place. And I'll just leave it at that. I'm not going to go into it right now. Several weeks ago, I brought up the subject of Pope John Paul II and my concern about where he was ages 19 to 25 in Krakow working in a chemical factory. And is he associated with IG Farben, counterintelligence operations? And we'll go into more detail on that Pope, the current Pope, later. But as a continuation of asking that question or the series on the Vatican at the present time, last week we talked about Pope John Paul I, his possible murder, and briefly on who would gain and the manipulations of covering up, the indifference of covering up his death, which obviously was to make ready for Pope John Paul II. And in this interim, I've read a lot of books. I will be giving you the list of books on the Vatican and on the IG Farben operation. I'm sure that you can collect many more books than I have and begin to send me titles to fill in the missing pieces. And one of the subscribers to these weekly tapes sent me a marvelous book, and I'm going to talk about it on both sides today and analyze some of the material in it. It's called The Final Conclave by Malachi Martin. It's put out by Pocket Books, New York, 1978. You can get it right now. Pocketbooks is a branch of Gulf and Western, which I thought was funny because in here Mr. Martin goes in and tells how the Vatican has money invested in Gulf and Western. But The Final Conclave is a very, very important book. And just before I get to it, I just want to give you a quotation. I don't know if I've read this before on the air or not, and some of you have it. It's by Ladislaus Fargo, who wrote The Game of the Foxes and Patton. It's from the book called Aftermath, and I think we could read it quite often and share the information. He begins the introduction by saying, Martin Bormann, former Reichsleiter, head of the Nazi Party Chancery and Secretary of the Fuhrer, survived World War II and managed to escape to Argentina in 1948 with the help of the Perón regime. He said, I have authoritative proof that Bormann survived the war and went to Argentina in 1948. Then he goes on later in the book and he says, Monsignor Montini, and that is, Montini is the Pope Paul VI, who preceded John Paul I. You have that list of popes that I printed out last week for you. Monsignor Montini headed the Section 2 of the Secretariat in charge of the day-to-day conduct of the Holy See's international affairs. More important in this context, Montini had under his supervision the Vatican Bureau that issued the refugee travel documents and the Caritas Internationalis, the church's international welfare organization, which was at this time and for some years after the war one of the main charitable institutions that aided fugitive Nazis. Caritas Internationalis is not officially part of the Vatican Curia. Even today, when he wrote this book, it is not listed under the Curia or under the official register of the Holy See. In reality, though, it does belong to part of the Curia. He said even in 1949, branches of Caritas were aiding Nazi fugitives in their escape to Argentina, such as Dr. Hans Heffelmann, one of the accused at the euthanasia trial, testified at Limburg in 1964 when he described in detail how the Vienna branch of the organization supplied travel documents and money he needed to make it to Argentina. And around 1947, the Department of the Vatican Secretary of State helped displaced persons was under the direction of Monsignor Jose Montini, whose assistant in providing travel documents for refugees was an Argentinian priest named Silva. It was the latter who was the link between the Bishop of Genoa, Monsignor Giuseppe Suri, who's one of the chief conservatives of the Curia at the present time and a big wheel in the Vatican right now, the wife of the President of the Republic of Argentine, Signora Maria de Peron, and formerly Deputy Fuhrer Martin Bormann. The main interview for them took place in the vicinity of Genoa, and they were all instrumental in removing Martin Bormann down to Argentine. I just read that for you now because the book, The Final Conclave, goes into the manipulations of Montini, later being so instrumental in wheeling and dealing in the financial world business of the Vatican, that does affect the selections of the popes and foreign policy for both the church and the United States government. Martin, in the book, gives a little historical background about Montini and the elections that are to follow. He said there was a struggle inside the Vatican that was far-reaching, a revolution that appeared on its way that the Roman Catholic Church would have to face. And that comes out again in the article that I mentioned last week on the politics of the Vatican, whether it's going to meet the future and move with the future or stay in the past. The Vatican thinking is the conflict of Jesus versus Satan, the battle for the souls. And I think this is one reason why the Moonies and the various church cults have appeared, and the Billy Grahams and the TV Christians and the born again Christians and the youth Christian movements is to try to turn the entire world Christian through mass satellites, communications, and televisions, if not this entire generation, certainly the next one. Martin went on to say that the far left and the far right of the church doesn't represent the opinions of a majority. They never have. But for better or worse, their idea is this battle of Jesus versus Satan. And that Giovanni Battista Montini, who became the Pope in 1963, had a big part in swinging the minds of the church around from the way John 23rd saw the world, that Montini had a different view of the Jesus versus Satan group, and that he faced a direction, according to Martin, this is a quote, that the vast majority didn't want and didn't understand. He was a great innovator, but he saw over everybody's head. Now, he doesn't go into the role that I just quoted of siphoning these Nazis, being the Secretary of the Vatican, and shifting them out and getting ready for World War III or creating the Spider, the underground Odessa Nazi network, writing these passports out of the Vatican. But certainly, I don't think the people who suffered in Verdun or the streets of Europe that were bombed out or lost 80 million lives gone and 80 million more displaced would have approved of letting these Nazis out. They never questioned where they were. Many of them thought of them as dead or missing. And he has changed the course of history for the future. I believe he has. And Martin doesn't specifically say what he did to change the direction of the church. I'm interpreting that from what I know about him. But he said he faced it in the direction that a vast majority didn't want and didn't understand. Then he goes into the background of Montini, who he says was never welcomed by the Romans. He was never part of the Roman clique. He came from Milan. They called him the Milan Mafia. But I can see now that his ties in Milan had to be with Reinhard Gehlen, chief of Hitler's Eastern Division of Intelligence, because of his future connections and what he does with the Vatican investments. But they called him part of the Milan Mafia. And at one time, Montini was exiled. He wasn't trusted by Pope Pius XII. Even Pope Pius XII excommunicated him and sent him to Milan, where he built up his own power base and returned victorious as the Pope. June 21st, 1963, months before John Kennedy is to be killed in November 1963. The 15th anniversary of that was just this week, 2 days ago. And Pope Paul brought with him from Milan his own architects, his own financiers, his own clerics, his publishing house, which has to be the Minister of Propaganda, because he does get the best PR of any pope. He comes out as a lover of peace, a lover of the Third World, and there isn't a piece of evidence I can see to support that kind of PR. But he had his own publishers and designers and art people and came in, and the people in Rome called him for years the Milan Mafia. He had this camaraderie among him, his servants, that he brought with him from Milan, and they met a lot of hostility in Rome, but it didn't matter. He had the entourage that he needed. And Martin describes in the book, I'm quoting most of the time now, not from Aftermath, but from the book The Final Conclave by Malachy Martin. And he describes people around Montini, particularly Cardinal Viot, V-I-L-L-O-T. I mentioned him last week. Viot was the man who took over the Vatican. He has the important role when Montini died of securing and taking care of the interim business until the next pope is selected. When John Paul I was selected, Viot was the last person with him that night when he went to bed. Montini's very close cohort was with his successor, John Paul, and he also did that little knocking on the forehead, are you there, that three-time knocking to make sure he was well dead. Cardinal Viot has a lot of political clout, and this book was written before Pope John Paul died or was murdered, and John Paul II was selected, and he even goes into the book on page 76 how the Polish Pope was selected and mentions this Pope Carol and the manipulation of the Germans and the Americans to get the Polish Pope in. And the clique was Montini and Cardinal Viot, and he tells how he brought him into the Vatican, worked with him. This was a French cardinal, and how they worked together, and Viot, in quotes, developed a bureaucratic competence from a lifetime of petty bargaining. Pope Pius XII, I don't want to get you confused, so you can always look back to the insert that came with the tape from last week. Pope Pius XII manipulated the history like a game of chess. This is according to Martin. He saw the world as a chessboard with boundaries and geography and local history. This was a man active through the Cold War period. Cardinal Pacelli had been instrumental in helping the Nazis and the Italians in the period of the Spanish Civil War. Pius XII saw the world as a history board, that the enemy was Marxism, and this was his complex that we have to go after Marxism. And then came John 23rd, who saw the world differently, according to Martin, with a broad overview, one of peace, and he didn't feel that the world was a deadly conflict between the good and the bad, or Jesus versus Satan, or the Marxists. And he saw the world differently with a larger change. Politically and ideologically, Martin describes that the vision that John had was that the world was divided for years with no validity, that people from all kinds of persuasions could get together and not harm each other and love each other. This was Paul 23rd. And that the old boundaries that separated people would disappear, and that people would get along. And maybe John's feelings was the birth of the real hippie movement, the real Jesus people, the simple people who broke down the barriers of rich and poor and black and white. And that was a warm time after the Cold War period, when John Kennedy had pulled back the invasion from Cuba, didn't go on a gung-ho tirade against Khrushchev. They had the nuclear test ban treaty, and the world looked like it was going to be a little better place for just a short while. I think the grieving after the death of John Kennedy, his assassination, and after John the 23rd was legitimate, and people sensed that the good feeling that they were trying to spread was coming to an end. And in John's place came the mysterious Milan Mafia, the Montini, the Secretary Montini, former Secretary to the Vatican, who replaced Pope John the 23rd and became known as Paul the VI. The final conclave goes into the manipulations of Pope Paul the VI when he came to the United Nations in 1965 with his entourage and his trip to the United States, and then he details what happened 1 year later in 1966, the countries that lost their civil liberties and the Vatican didn't speak up. He talks about Haiti, South Africa, Dominican Republic, Guatemala, Indonesia, the Cuban refugees, the Spanish refugees, the Tibetan refugees, and he goes into the mass movements of hundreds of thousands of people 1 year later after Paul VI was at the United Nations. And the book goes into the statistics of billions of dollars in armament that Paul sat before the representatives of nations who had accumulated armaments in 1966. And he goes into the billions of the United Kingdoms and the United States and the Arab nations and how they could have prevented the war of June 1967 in the Middle East. And as much as said that the so-called religious leader did a monkey appeasement speech with no meaning at the UN, and then 1 year later, all hell breaks out all over the world in 66 in terms of money and lives and murder and further repressions. And he goes into a secret meeting in 1969, which he describes as the most secluded in the papal study. It was at night, late at night, in the papal study on the third floor of the palace. No more secluded and secure and private time and place has been found for any previous meetings for popes, for any such ultra-secret meetings. I'm sure there have been some, but we're talking about a pope that helped the Nazis escape from Europe in the Vatican, who was in the OSS, and now he's having a secret meeting in 1969 with a man named Michel Sindona, S-I-N-D-O-N-A, and Pope Paul is alone with Michel Sindona. And at that meeting, he signs his signature. He says, Paul binds and obliges a good part of the Vatican finance and the papal monies. He turns over to Sindona, and he authorizes him to sell the Vatican's controlling interest, $350 million in one corporation, and he gives Sindona access to other Vatican funds for further investment. He feels that the money centers should leave Europe. They should go to the United States, and he takes a signature from the Vatican, from Montini, now Pope Paul VI, to go over the world and begin to put money into investments for the Vatican. Martin goes into the fact that as Secretary of the Vatican for Pope Pius XII, that he was trying to reform the financial administration even at that time, and that there were reports of manipulation of money, a 1954 report exposing Pope Pius XII of abuses of money, and at that time Montini was exiled for coming across these abuses. There's also mention of another scandal, in Ernesto Cipico, who embezzled thousands of dollars of funds from the Vatican that was for Eastern European refugee groups. It reminds me of Herbert Hoover in the United States taking money that was supposed to go to refugee groups and putting in it to white Russian Tsarist army that formed the nucleus of World War II. He says that Montini knew that there were people with Vatican money, that they could buy wars, they could sell peace down the river. This is what Martin is saying, that they can sell peace down the river with this kind of money. And the only difference between one scandal and another, which is true any place else as well as the Vatican, is do you have protection in high places, and how much can you get away with? The background of the accumulation of Vatican wealth is important, as important as where they're to invest it later and where it is today and how it affects the selections of our popes. And I'll run down it briefly just to give you a little background again on it. There was the Institute for Religious Works called the IRW that he describes in his book, set up, as I told you before, during World War I, that accumulated into assets of $3 billion. It grew into assets of $3 billion. There's no balance sheet that's ever been reduced. These huge amount of monies have now been transferred all over the world. They go back and forth, and even during World War II, money was invested in both sides. It's like the book, The Merchants of Death, making weapons for both sides. It didn't matter if it was good for the investment, the Vatican profit. There was a body of money called the Special Administration of Holy See Property, a special administration known as SA, dating back to that year in 1929 when Mussolini was given 100 million, and in this book he says 2.4 million in exchange for staying neutral. That figure varies by 1 million depending which source you read. But that money was invested by three different banking houses. One, the J.P. Morgans in New York, the other, the Hambros brothers in London, and the third was the Rothschilds in Paris. And by the late 60s, the IRW, that's the Institute for Religious Works, and the SA, the Special Administration of Holy See Property, had been invested in Italian industry and commerce, and it ran into the billions. It involved much of the industry that goes on just right, located in Italy as well as around the world, even in a company that made birth control contraceptives. The Vatican had a share of that company. Then they invested money in the Societe Generale Immobiliare, the SGI, highly diversified, which included the Rome Hilton, the Pan American Building in the Champs-Élysées in Paris, the Watergate complex that was built in 1968 for $60 million, and the Stock Exchange in Montreal. Pope Paul VI worried about the European economy and started the PECA, which was the Prefecture of Economic Affairs, and began to invest elsewhere in 1968 and put money in the hands of a career diplomat by the name of Cardinal Vagnosi, who spent 9 years in Washington, D.C. So that the power of the Vatican, the power of investment, was now moved across the Atlantic, and it was on this side with this huge, tremendous amount of millions and billions of dollars. The IRW, which was the Institute for Religious Works, got a new head. They funded and appointed a new head, a Father Marcinkus, M-A-R-C-I-N-K-U-S, a priest from Chicago and Cicero, Illinois, who accompanied Montini on his trips around the world and was under salary to the IRW in Illinois. And when I think about that, I wonder about Cicero, Illinois, or the relationships close to Chicago of the demonstration of the Nazis versus the victims of Auschwitz in that sensitive area. And were these provocateurs just a symptom of warming up of the future Nazi feeling, getting the American civil liberties to defend their right to say that they could kill blacks and Jews and do away with freedom of speech, which is what the Nazi party is about? And there is a lot of money from IRW right in Cicero, Illinois, and in Chicago. Paul's aim, according to the book The Final Conclave, was to stop the Vatican system of controlling interest in Italian companies and then put it in the blue chips, in the offshore profits. And so with his secret meeting of Michael Sindona, selected as the man to do his overseas investments, we have an interesting combination, because at one time, as I say, Montini worked with the OSS. He was active in setting up the Odessa, letting these people leave in the year 1946 to 48, which was the 2 years that the protege of Paul VI, Pope Paul VI, John Paul II, was in Rome. He was in Poland, in Krakow, and Wadowice, working for that chemical factory up till 1946, and he went to Rome for 2 years, and he was a protege of Montini up to the time that Montini died. And when Montini died, Pope Paul VI, he left all the political clout and framework for the current Paul John II. Sindona started with an interesting career. He worked with the United States Army forces in wartime Sicily. He had military contacts there, And according to Martin, he spent 20 years preparing for the work that he was to do with Martin, as if it took a lifetime of preparation for this moment that he was to meet and get this huge investment. I know Reinhard Gehlen wrote in his biography how an espionage operation, a rearming Germany from World War I to World War II, could take 20 years, and it didn't mean a thing, that you have a lot of time for important connections. And the book describes that he was almost set up for this special moment that when he was to meet Montini and receive all of this money for overseas investment. By 1969, according to Martin, Sindona was well on his way to become a great investment banker. By 59, he was well on his way, and by 69, he had signed the contract with Montini, Pope Paul VI, to make these investments. Up to that time, he had tax havens in Liechtenstein and in Geneva and all around the world. And by the time he came to Montini's attention, according to Martin, Sindona was a legal counsel for textile groups. He worked for a company called Keys Italiano. He was the president. He worked for Mediterranean Holidays, I guess a vacation resort group, the Philip Carbon Black Italiano, managing director of the Cheeseboro Ponds, a board member of Remington Rand Italiano, and he donated $2.4 million for an old people's home, which impressed Montini. And on the basis of that, he contacted Sindona to begin to make these investments for him. They go on to point out that he was a Freemason, but I don't know why they threw that in, I guess to fire the conspiratorial feelings about Masons that have been spread around. But Pope Paul VI felt that Sindona was an instrument in the hands of unknown powers, and yet he could go on from 69 and start investing all this Vatican money, and he moved quickly on several fronts, and they described his putting $40 million into a Luxembourg bank and $15 million into the California-based Gulf and Western, and Gulf and Western also owned Paramount Pictures. And then the Vatican investments begin to spread to General Motors, General Electric, Shell Oil, which is Prince Bernhard and Juliana over the Netherlands, that formed the Bilderbergers and the Trilateral money, and the Gulf Oil, which was exposed at the time of Watergate. It was through the Gulf money down in Houston, Texas, that came in from Mexico, that went up to Maurice Stans Bank, the committee to reelect the president, and then down to Miami to Bernard Barker's bank. That was Gulf money, and then into the pockets of the Watergaters, all important, back to the Watergate Hotel owned by the Vatican. It's really a full cycle and a pretty cozy relationship here, and I don't mean to just throw out a lot of names, but the Vatican now is very well diversified with millions and billions, and into General Motors, General Electric, Shell, IBM, and some airlines, it says, it doesn't mention them. Then Sindona went on to make, in quotes, forge links further with his banks and Vatican investments with the Continental Bank of Illinois. The chairman of Continental Bank was David Kennedy, the secretary of the United States Treasury under Richard Nixon, and later a board member of Sindona's own company. A very cozy relationship of the Vatican money of an OSS agent and Vatican money to what is a really WASP Gentile non-Catholic organizations. He's meeting up with the Eastern Council of Foreign Relations, the blue chip companies of the United States, which are not Catholic owned and weren't, but the Vatican is investing money into the Protestant and other banks in the United States of America and merging their future and their investments with their political and financial futures are melded with the power structure of the United States government, which basically is not Catholic. 1968, the Vatican was having trouble with Italian authorities and was being penalized over some of its financial connections. And there's an interesting story here because Aldo Moro, the premier of Italy, wanted the Vatican taxed on some of its investments that it had, these massive amounts of holdings that were not taxed. And Aldo Moro, who was kidnapped later and murdered, was opposing the Vatican's right to hold on to these properties and not pay taxes like ordinary citizens. In 1968, it began to worry Pope Paul VI about possible hassles of their holdings, and in 69, he gave control to this vast fortune of overseas money that the Vatican had, and he began to invest it in other places around the world. Sindona left the Vatican, according to Martin. He kissed the Pope's ring, and he left, in quotes, with as much financial power as many nations. And he went about dealing Vatican money into the foreign markets and investing it for the Vatican in the hands of Sindona, according to this material, ordered by Montini, the mysterious Montini of the OSS, who's now pushing the wealth of the Vatican into the hands of the U.S. financiers. On the other side of this tape, we'll continue the links of the Vatican Empire to the blue chip companies and the power structure of the United States, which can easily explain why Mr. Brzezinski and the Kissinger crowd and the Rockefeller crowd can select the next pope to create the warfare state, along with their fears of Marxism and communism, and get us on the brink of World War III.